Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you want?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face,
not
say it to now.
I'm down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Arsene Wenger said finishing in the top four was like a trophy. And listen, a bronze medal is still an Olympic medal. And after a while, no one really remembers what colour exactly the medal that you actually won was. It didn't really feel like Leicester and Chelsea were winners doing what they do best yesterday. They weren't exactly engaged in a high-quality race to the finish line. They both pretty much tried to hijack their own season. Only one of them could be successful in that particular endeavour, and it is Chelsea and Liverpool, not the FA Cup champions Leicester, who join the Manchester clubs in the Champions League next year. Leicester, who spent 92% of the last two seasons in the top four, only to finish fifth twice, as Gary Lineker informed me last night. That's got to be a deep burn. Welcome to today's Second Captain's Football Show. Hello to you, Ken.
How are you?
92% of the last two seasons in the top four. Well, that's not great.
I mean, it's worse than that because it's like, well, I looked at the weeks and it was weeks 1, I think it was 1, 2, 5, 37 and 38 of last season that they weren't in the top four, and just weeks 37 and 38 of this season that they weren't in the top four. So, So, you know, you can say on one level Leicester were ultimately not good enough to finish ahead of Chelsea and Liverpool, but they were good enough to be ahead of, you know, some of the teams in the top four, all of the teams, in fact, in the top four, but none of whom have been in that bracket. None of whom have spent as much time in that bracket as Leicester over the last two seasons. None of them. So you do wonder, why is it that this keeps happening right at the very end, you know?
If they had won yesterday, like forgetting about the last few, if they had won yesterday, then they'd be in the Champions League.
Yeah, if they'd done it, all they need to do is beat Tottenham. And remember that Tottenham in their midweek game against Aston Villa seemed to me one of the worst teams I'd ever seen play in the Premier League.
Yeah, it wasn't even so much that. It was more that it was a club in free fall to an extent that maybe you've never seen before, Ken. A club in free fall like you've never seen before, as Donald Trump
was. Yeah, and you could say, well, the pressure was off Tottenham and they were able to play with freedom. But the pressure, first of all, wasn't totally off Tottenham. The Europa Conference League was on the line, and they, you know, and finishing ahead of Arsenal, you know, to the extent that that's still important, you know, I mean, the two, you know, it is bald men fighting over comb territory this season between Arsenal and Tottenham, but let the record state that Tottenham did, in the end, finish ahead of Arsenal. Arsenal, who finished the season like a train, the only team apart from Liverpool to win their last five in a row. But it wasn't enough to overtake. It wasn't enough to overtake Tottenham. And I mean, you could point out that Tottenham have, you know, some certain players who, let's say, would get in the Leicester team. That's certainly true. But the fact is, this has happened again, you know, and it's so depressing, I imagine, for Brendan Rodgers. I mean, if you, and of course they win the cup, and you're like, well, how can you say it's a bad season if you win the cup? Do you think Ben Chilwell would swap places with Leicester Do you think Ben Chilwell would swap places with his teammates at Leicester? That's my question.
No, Ben Chilwell would not swap places with his former Leicester teammates.
Why do you think he wouldn't? I mean, it's silverware, isn't it? What do you think it is about playing in the Champions League that Ben Chilwell is going to be more excited about than, say, Youri Tielemans? My boy Tielemans, by the way, I don't know if you noticed, his defending at times in the game was a little bit ropey. And people questioned why I didn't put him in the team of the season. I did, if you recall, I did say, you know, he's been...
I do recall it. Yeah, I do recall good, it,
but,
Ken.
You know, there's a question mark for me there. There's a question mark. You know, I think, would Thomas Soucek have given Gareth Bale that much space at the edge of the area to pick his spot? You know, or would he have got out there and stuck a limb of some description in the middle of Gareth Bale's face? You know, I think he might have done that. Maybe it wouldn't
that
have been
too
so easy.
Is part of midfield play, Ken.
It is. And
25-yard screamers, yes, fine. Sticking a leg in Gareth Bale's face, also a part of the job.
I said a limb. I didn't say necessarily a leg. He, Tielemans, if you saw what he did, he ran back into the box and then showed his concern by sort of, oh my God, what's going to happen? Like sort of staring at Harry Kane like a frightened meerkat, and then was taken by surprise when Kane passed the ball back to the edge of the area to really the only other Tottenham player who could affect things. But Tielemans hadn't noticed him until it was too late, and that was Gareth Bale's first goal. And I think the less said about Gareth Bale's second goal from Leicester's point of view, the better. I mean, that's very much the ship is going down. That's the ship is slipping beneath the waterline type of...
Soyuncu ran across Gareth Bale's path like a floor manager in a TV studio who realizes, oh my God, I'm in shop. I need to get...
I've wandered into literally, shop.
Yeah, completely by accident. This is a complete nightmare. That's how quickly he moved out of Gareth Bale. I really shouldn't be here. Coming up this week, we have the Europa League final, the Champions League final. We'll be covering all that on the Second Captain's World Service, which you can join right now for just €5 a month plus VAT. There are the Euros coming up very, very soon as well. So quite frankly, can you afford not to join us? We'll be talking to Rory Smith and Jonathan Wilson in just a few moments. But time now, Ken, for your report on sport, your Barclays Premier League season ending report on sport.
So why is it, just getting back to that point about Chilwell, why would Chilwell not swap positions now with his Leicester team? And not just because, like, I've left Leicester, I've burned my bridges, I heard how they booed me at Wembley, you know, not just because, you know, regret is rare, no one ever tells themselves they made the wrong decision. You know, Ben Chilwell is not going to be there saying, I shouldn't have left Leicester. Not for any of these reasons, just on an appraisal of the cold, hard facts of the situation that any professional footballer just at a glance would be able to understand why.
Well, I mean, it's similar to being named in the Euros, isn't it? I mean, in your national Euro squad, it's the pinnacle of the game. You know, and the Champions League is even more so the pinnacle of the game probably than, you know, someone squeaking into the Scotland 26.
Well, you know, I wouldn't necessarily downgrade the achievement of the 26th best footballer of Scotland, but you know, that is essentially it. It's not just that. It's not just the status. It's also, you know, not that we want to talk about it, but it's also the money. Money and status is a really unbeatable combination.
It's kind of like why we keep talking about, you know, Killian Sheridan being the last Irishman to play in the Champions League or whatever. And no, that's not true since Caoimhín Kelleher played. But, you know, it was still a thing, and it was kind of like a badge of shame for us as a nation that, you know, we didn't have
a champion. We can't get anyone in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can't get anyone in there. Well, that's why, you know, and I think ultimately the Leicester players there's been a lot of stuff recently because Brendan Rodgers, obviously, he's one of those guys who he's a sort of a self-made football man, you know. Nothing was handed to Brendan Rodgers. He's had to point out a lot of his own achievements because, you know, in football, people try to take credit. There's lots of people involved in any particular triumph. I mean, you can't do it without at least, you know, 10 teammates on the field, more of them off the bench, coaches, staff, owners, fans, even. You know, there's lots of people who want a share of the rewards when the time comes to dole out those rewards. And so if you're someone like Brendan Rodgers, you know, a player who ultimately didn't make the grade because of injury, you know, a coach who's worked his way up. You know, it's not as though people are going to be turning around and saying, hang on a second here. What about Brendan Rodgers? Maybe he deserves his share of the credit. No, you gotta elbow. You gotta have sharp elbows. You gotta, you know, if you're one of the little tweeting birds in the nest and you don't open your mouth particularly wide, you just sort of politely wait around the back, saying, "I'm sure they'll get round to me eventually. After all, they all saw that I was integral to the success. I'm sure they'll get round to doling out the credit that I deserve." You're not going to get any credit. You know, and sometimes maybe people have misinterpreted this entirely realistic appraisal of his situation that Brendan Rodgers has shown and subsequent behavior as some kind of egotism. You know, as when he mentioned in his post-match FA Cup interview, you know, the club's never done this before. You know, he pointed out that his post-match interview in the FA Cup, that is, you know, we never won this before, you know, until I came. So, you know, you got to do these things. If you're Brendan Rodgers, and maybe at times it's made him a little bit of a target, just because he gives it's not so much ammunition as material. He gives people so much material to work with. Unlike, you know, someone like Zinedine Zidane, who's obviously at the opposite extreme of things from Brendan Rodgers, in that he was like a legendary player of world football history, and as a coach says almost nothing. Just, you know, he just treats questions with just the ultimate, the absolute bare minimum. He's literally, every answer of his in press conference might as well be, "I'm here because, you know, for contractual reasons." What was it that NBA player
"I'm only
said?
Here, it was Marshawn Lynch, the NFL player. "I'm only here so I don't get fined."
That's Zidane in every press conference. "I'm here so I don't get fined." Whereas Rodgers has to kind of, has to be his own Boswell. Like he has to document, he has to fill in his own backstory, he has to document his own career history, and so he provides all this material to Grace. When things like yesterday happen, all the material can turn into ammunition. It's like Trump with the soup, you know. It's like it's soup for my family, but like it's also better than a brick, you know. And this is the problem. This is the problem when you're Brendan Rodgers. You have to give this material, otherwise, you know, people maybe aren't going to notice you. But then when you do, it's like, well, you know, you said this thing and you said this thing. Like, say for instance, his whole thing of when Leicester had sort of turned around the season, they hadn't turned around the season, rather, they'd recovered from the gut-wrenching disappointment of the end of last season when they slipped out of the Champions League. It wasn't quite as bad, I think, last season as this season, because last season they actually lost a direct head-to-head on the last day against Manchester United, which they needed to win. So they finished, United were a point ahead of them going into the game with the King Power. So Leicester needed to beat Man United. And if they did, they would finish ahead of them. But if they drew, then United were going to finish ahead of them. And so it was like they started the game a goal down. You know what I mean? Whereas in this case, okay, they also needed to win, but they were playing against Tottenham, who, unlike United that day, didn't also have the prize of this to fight for, have been, as we've talked about, in a lavishly documented crisis. And so, anyway, the point is, last season, what happened when this failure happened? Remember, it was August as well. It was like really late. As Rodgers himself said before this game, it's been a long season. It's been a long two seasons, really. It was like he was thinking that. It's been a long two seasons, really. It's like two seasons rolled into one, which I thought, yeah, it actually does feel that way. I suppose it was then a mid-season break between the last season's 38 game campaign going into the clausura of this 38 game campaign that he whisked his players away to the Grove Hotel in Hertfordshire, a five-star resort of unimaginable luxury. And because obviously he wanted to pamper them and he wanted for them to feel special, of course, but also They needed to talk. They had stuff to talk about. As he said himself, "We need to talk about the elephant in the room." The great quote from Rodgers around Christmas time, the most recent Christmas, was, "You know, obviously, straight after the end of the season, you don't qualify for the Champions League, and people may want to tell you you failed." He said, "So that was he needed to dispel that idea," and he did so essentially by saying, "Look, you know, guys. The fact is, we can talk, about failing to qualify for the Champions League. But guys, let's get real. You know, let's consider where we've where we started from. You know, it's not a case of oh my God, you know, we finished miles behind Liverpool and Man City. They're 5 years into a 5 year plan. You know, our 5 year plan has only just begun. It's 18 months into it. You know, don't compare yourself to where other people are today. Compare yourself to where you were yesterday. You know,
mm-hmm.
and if you look at where Leicester City were yesterday, which is to say at the end of the previous campaign, they were 10 points further back. You know, their goal difference they improved their goal difference by more than 20 goals, and 23 goal improvement in their goal difference, and a 10 point increase in their points. So, like, these are substantial improvements. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And they'd finished fifth. Okay, that was disappointing, but you know, they'd had a real good go at it. And you could see that they'd grown. The problem almost is like what does he say now? And also that he's sort of said all this. He's kind of pointed all this out. Where it that it can now be used against him.
Well,
it's like,
they won the cup for the first time in their history. Four finals in a row, you know.
It's true. But the cup is almost a bit of a booby prize, isn't it? Like, I'm thinking of Louis van Gaal being bundled out the door waving the cup.
Yeah, well,
you know,
I mean, I think it's different for Leicester. Like, they had never won it before. Like, this brings, you know, their big English domestic trophy hold to two. So, I mean,
they had never won it before. Yeah, no, it's and you know, in fairness, it's big. It's big to say that you've won the cup. But in terms of progress as a club, I don't know if it really. If it's hard to sort of sell the same story. I mean, you could say, well, Leicester have had injuries. A lot of teams have had injuries. You know what I mean? Certainly, Liverpool, looking ahead of Leicester, have had some pretty bad injuries this season. And, you know, and if you can't finish ahead of them in the season when all this happens, then it's hard to see how that's going to happen. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And it does sort of feed into a kind of an impression around Rodgers. Why does this keep happening? You know what I mean? Why does it keep happening? And the problem is that the problem for Rodgers is that until he is able to come out of one of these situations winning, that just kind of continues to build. I mean, consider that, you know, until the Champions League final in 2019, that there was that sort of thing had built around Jurgen Klopp. This guy can't get it over the line.
Mm.
You know, he can't win.
Can't win finals.
He lost six in a row or something, or whatever it was. I think it was six in a row. Yeah, he was going to be the seven time wonder. Who loses seven in a row? It's a tough situation.
It's a tough beat. You know, it is a tough beat. They won one of their last five games, was it, in the Premier League? Like, that's...
They lost five of their last nine. And I mean, it's like when you look at, like, they lost to Newcastle. You know what I mean? They lost to Newcastle when they couldn't really afford. I mean, in fairness, Newcastle won five of their last eight, I think. I mean, if only Leicester could have finished the season like Newcastle, then they would be in the Champions League, and Chelsea would be the ones who had blown up. You know, having, like, I mean, and it really was looking that way until Kasper Schmeichel managed to punch the ball into his own net, which is just
Bernard Brogan levels of skill being displayed by Kasper Schmeichel. And I've seen Bernard Brogan score basically that goal in he scored three goals in All-Ireland finals basically exactly like that. Not good.
Not good. So what else is going on? Okay, there was obviously Man City.
Man City. Let's talk about Man City's title celebrations and one moment in particular, Ken.
Well, I mean, I was watching a bit of this after the game, and Aguero, I mean, first of all, like,
wow,
why was Aguero sitting on the bench until 65 minutes of this game? You know, eventually Pep decided to put him on. He was brought on 65 minutes. He scored on 71 minutes, and then he scored again on 75 minutes, a goal which I only then realized, which I'm sure had been spoken about in the build-up, and everybody, you know, everyone around Aguero, certainly he knew about it, and everyone at City would have known about it, but this was the goal he needed to break Wayne Rooney's record for the most Premier League goals for a single club, which is an amazing way for him to...
And the record, that sounds like a pretty important record, to be honest.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, it's, like, a nice, it's a nice one to have.
Yeah, it's a lot, there are a lot of statistical anomaly records, which, you know, we can take or leave. But, like, that's a pretty big one. And the idea that, like, they form a guard of honor. He walks out. Everyone applauds Sergio Aguero. Then he goes to the bench.
That's why I couldn't... Like, I was amazed by it because I wasn't watching the City game because obviously there wasn't really a lot at stake in the City game. But I did see... I saw the beginning of it and I saw this happen. I thought, what kind of a send-off is this? This is weird. You know, why don't you just play him? It's his last game. I mean, maybe he is saving him for the Champions League final. I mean, you know, we will see. But I don't expect him to... I don't expect him to start in the Champions League final. You know, maybe he's trying to cotton wool him for injury. And I suppose, in, you know, if you're thinking about tuning up a player for the Champions League final, then ultimately it worked out reasonably well. And it's not that big a deal, but it just did seem, in the context of this post-match interview from Pep Guardiola, and this is Guardiola in the middle of the celebrations coming over to speak to, like, the Sky team, and he's sort of standing behind a barrier. It was a little bit awkward the way that it began. I thought, because Guardiola is standing too far away from them, how can he hear them? But they eventually managed to start the interview, and Guardiola just found it difficult to keep going at the same speed.
Was it just typical of him, the 30 minutes that we saw of him out there today?
We love him so much. He's a special person for all of us.
You're not having second thoughts, are you, Pep?
He's so nice.
Is it because of the human being as well as the footballer?
Yeah, he helped me a lot.
It's been the challenge for you. You've had to do it replacing totems of this football club.
We cannot replace him. We cannot. There are many players that this club, Joe Hart and David Silva, help us to be this club what it is. So we have his legacy and he show his quality.
Yeah, I mean, I've seldom seen a manager as choked with emotion for as obscure reasons as that. I mean, why did Pep start to cry? I didn't understand. What was it? Did he feel bad about?
Yeah,
booting Aguero out of the club.
If it's sadness, that's something. If it's guilt, then it makes maybe more sense. You know, I can't believe I had to do. It's like the final scene of The Godfather Part 2 when Michael realizes what he's done. Like, is that what we saw on the pitch yesterday? Just Pep, like, I will live with this brutal, tyrannical act for the rest of my life.
Is that what it was? I mean, you know, it was very...
Fratricide.
Very strange. I mean, okay, it would be taking it face value that Pep is upset to see Sergio Aguero leave. Why didn't you put him on before 65 minutes to give him a better chance of that record? I mean, it just seemed like, you know, the typical thing would be start him and then hope he scores the goals and then bring him off just before the end so he can get the big, you know,
ovation,
the big fanfare from the crowd. Not leave him on the bench for more than an hour. But then Pep, afterwards, he's speaking to Lineker and essentially revealed that Aguero is moving to Barcelona. I mean, this had obviously been mooted, but Pep kind of confirmed it. Well, he said, you know, he sort of was like, a little bird told me, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but I think he may be going to Barcelona to play with the best the world has ever seen.
The club of my heart, as Pep called it. Okay.
The club of my heart. Well, you know, it's... still, so I just couldn't quite square this, the emotion. You know, we cannot replace him with, like, the sort of attitude that he's had towards Aguero for most of the time that he's been there. You know, in the sense of, I'm sure he respects him as a good finisher, but, like, he's always seemed to see him as a sort of ultimately dispensable player. And it was, I mean, I don't know, we can't... Like Aguero, I wonder if he has really always been sort of underrated, you know, in the sense that you saw his goals to minutes ratio, it was like the best in Premier League history by miles. you know, by a long way. Is it, who was the next? Was it Thierry Henry on the list? Yeah. Was next on the list? A goal every 108 minutes or something.
Yeah, for anyone who scored over 50. I mean, so the list is stacked, but he's way ahead.
Yeah. And clearly he's been playing for the best team that's played in the Premier League, I guess, for some of those, some but not all of those seasons. You know, the City have had some good but not great teams in the period that he's been there, let's say. You know, and when Guardiola says he can't be replaced, I mean, I was struck by kind of in a weird way how sort of disconnected he seems from the club that he's been. He's such a legend. You know what I mean? City like have kind of looked after him, you know, obviously very well, given him the stage to play, you know, to play at the highest level. But you sort of feel as though it could have been anywhere else. the sort of Martin Tyler commentary thing, and you know, whatever band was playing. Like, did you see Aguero on the pitch at the end when they were sort of doing a there was this shambolic sort of goodbye ceremony when the sound didn't work, and there was some guy from City or some sort of MC they had saying, trying to do an interview with Aguero on the field, which, you know, is, you know, Aguero doesn't, he's not really an interview guy. He's like, so Sergio, you can hear just because the camera happens to be right up beside it, but not because the audio is coming through the stadium sound system as it's supposed to, which is because it wasn't. You hear the guy going, so Sergio, will the thing you miss most about Manchester be the weather? He says, as the freezing rain tips down. Yeah. It's a howling gale and everyone's wearing like a winter jacket. And Aguero is like, tries to speak then to the microphone. No sound comes out. And then you can hear Aguero go, it no work. Finish. Hey, like, I don't have to do this. And then
what a result! Thank you for this vital gift.
Thank you. And then they started playing like a list of, or rather, video tributes to Aguero from the screen in the stadium. But the sound didn't work. So everyone's kind of standing there, like listening to this very echoey sound. Aguero's like actually pulling his head down into his jacket because he's so cold. And the whole thing just like this. Let's just say, let's hope he gets a goal in the Champions League final to round things off in a better way. Although it was interesting that he had scored two goals as a substitute. The only other time he did that for City was on his debut. Which was 10 years ago, you know, against Swansea. So, I mean, I guess he hasn't been a substitute all that many times. But it was a nice little bookend. But when they talk about how we can't replace him, I wonder if, you know, what I'm talking about with Aguero being underrated or being a kind of a player who, like, when Aguero was doing interviews and stuff, I was like, oh, you know, I don't want to, I'm not interested because I've seen Sergio Aguero do too many interviews and he's always, obviously his command of the language isn't too good, and maybe he uses his well-known lack of ability in English to just to do the Zinedine Zidane on it. You know what I mean? And not really. So he's like, oh, I'm a striker. It is normal that I want to score goals, of course. You know, you're like, okay, I'm changing the channel. And I think maybe there's a bit of that in general towards Aguero, whose, let's say, charisma as a footballer has not equaled his on-field ability.
Yeah, so I saw people talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and someone mentioned like that he does these great twitches, that like he's, you know, that he,
really?
I'm not a twitcher again, but it was just interesting because that was basically what people came back with when people said that, basically made the point that you're making, that, you know, for like, we still don't know the guy at all. But I think it kind of goes even deeper than that, in that, you know, like, he never agitated for, like, a move in a really ballsy way. Like, he just turned up, scored tons of goals, went home again. And, you know, as you say, like, it could have been for anyone, you know? I am a professional footballer.
Been for anyone as long as they were among the tiny handful of the best clubs in the world.
You know, because he has been unbelievably good.
He has been a player at the highest level, not quite at the level that Barcelona or Real Madrid would want to sign him until now, apparently. I mean, it's interesting that Barcelona signed Aguero. When last summer they were waving goodbye to Luis Suarez, who has just won the league for Atletico. I mean, that's a whole other can of worms we could get into from their point of view.
Yeah.
But I guess that Aguero was going to Barcelona for a lot less money than Suarez was on. You know, the Suarez was on like an insane sort of 25 million type of, I mean, I say insane. I mean, he was worth it. He was worth it when he signed the contract. Whereas Aguero, I think, is going to be on a lot less than that. But considering they, you know, part of the reason for getting rid of Suarez was, do you really have the legs anymore, Luis, to bring in Aguero is just, okay. But the other thing, just on the point of City, because they have had this amazing player who maybe doesn't get the credit he deserves, in part because his personality doesn't really attract that much interest. And he is in a country where, he doesn't really speak to the fans in their own language. You know what I mean? There's not much for them to kind of latch onto in a way, you know, unless you're a City fan. And maybe this is what they're thinking they can address with Harry Kane. You know, because it feeds into that whole, you know, this whole meme of like City, oh, no one really cares. You know, they've won the league title. But like Alisson's goal was bigger than their title. You know, this type of stuff that goes on. And is this what they think maybe they can change by signing Harry Kane? You know, if you've got the England captain, is it a case of you have to pay attention to us now? I mean, imagine this title celebration is next season, but instead of Aguero saying, oh, it's normal to want to score goals, you've got Harry Kane weeping and saying how happy he is to have won his first Premier League title and would have, you know what I mean? Like,
and we're not finished yet. We will win the quadruple next week in the Champions League final.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying that Harry Kane is himself a sparkling personality. You know what I mean? Like he's Peter Ustinov or something. Like, you know, Harry Kane is like a fairly, you know, he's a bit of a roundhead personality-wise. You know, he's pretty much focused on scoring goals and so on and so forth.
Because it's normal to want to score goals, as we've discovered.
It's normal, you know, I'm in a good moment, you know. but he is, for all that, the England captain. And there is in England always going to be, like, if you're the England captain, that puts you right at the top of the sort of firmament of stars in the game in England, even if you're not a laugh a minute necessarily. And I think maybe this is one of the reasons why, because I'm trying to make sense of City's apparent interest in Kane.
Yeah.
And I think this might be at the root of it.
Another man saying goodbye yesterday, Gini Wijnaldum.
Yeah, and I don't know if you saw his statement. It was sort of interesting. He put out a statement, you know, on Instagram. I mean, he did interviews and obviously got big. He did get the send off in terms of he was substituted a few minutes before the end for the fans who were there to, and then a guard of honor back onto the pitch after and blah blah blah. And obviously their season had a happy ending with qualifying for the Champions League, which is when Alden pointed out no one would have thought they could do. Well, maybe some people would have thought they could do, but most people probably would have thought, nah, you've blown it. And they managed to eventually win 8 and draw 2 of the last 10 to get there. Wijnaldum's statement is, you know, it's really emotional for me right now, blah, blah, blah. On the other, you know, I'm happy we got third place. On the other hand, I'm fighting back tears. The people in Liverpool have shown me so much love. It's very hard to say goodbye. Like, Jurgen Klopp had some amazing stuff in his program notes about Wijnaldum. He says, Gini Wijnaldum, an LFC legend now and forever. What this person, this wonderful, joyful, selfless person has done for our team, I cannot sum in words. He is the architect of our success. We've built this Liverpool on his legs, lungs, brain, and his huge, beautiful heart. If, and it is still if, he goes, he does so knowing we, as his teammates, are eternally grateful for having this special human being come into our lives. I love him, and he will always be family. Okay, so that's about as positive a message as you can imagine from a manager, a better player. But Wijnaldum's statement, as I was saying, you know, he's talking about the fans singing his name, the prizes, blah, blah, blah. I would have loved to remain a Liverpool player for many more years, but unfortunately things went different. I have to start a new adventure. I didn't sign somewhere else. Everyone knows in football everything can happen. The situation right now is that as of July 1st, I'm not a Liverpool player anymore. We will see what I will do in the next couple of weeks. I will rest a little bit, then go to the national team. I will have a look at my story and how everything went. The fans deserve to know the story behind it. So that's an interesting little one from Wijnaldum. Because until now, it's kind of seemed, you know, as breakups go, quite amicable. Mm. It's like, you know, it's been great, but at the same time, all things come to a natural end, and, you know, maybe there's, maybe it is time for a new adventure. But he's saying, I have to
and
go.
And also, you'll hear from my lawyers.
Yeah.
I'd prefer to talk through the lawyers.
Yeah, no, I think essentially, I don't know if we have to read that far between the lines here. It seems as though they just didn't offer him what he felt he was worth. I mean, he is 30 years old now and is looking for, you know, probably more a longer contract than they're prepared to offer him because he's 30 years old. But I find it sort of interesting, like, there's 30-year-olds and there's 30-year-olds, you know? I mean, like... Zlatan Ibrahimovic is still playing. Well, okay, maybe he is coming to the end. I mean, he's nearly 40, and he has got an injury now. But, you know, Zlatan, until quite recently, was playing in the AC Milan first team. Wayne Rooney, a couple of years younger than him, is the manager of Derby County. You know what I mean? Like, age is not just a number, but people differ in terms of their athletic capacity. You know, look at Fernandinho yesterday. Like, for, if it was Fernandinho who jumped on Tom Davis for, you know, Tom, he must be getting on for 15 years older than Tom Davis, but he was still sharper than him, got onto him, won the ball for Aguero's record breaking goal. And what's Fernandinho? He's like 36 now, so a good bit older than Gini Wijnaldum as well. Wijnaldum played 86% of the minutes for Liverpool this season. He played in every Premier League game. I mean, remember, this is a season when everyone's been injured. And he plays in every Premier League game because he hasn't been injured since 2014. He has not been injured since 2014. I think that's a kind of... Now, you could say on one hand, well, I mean, look, the guy's...
A lot of miles on the clock.
Yeah, you could say that. But, like, also, if you're going to use the vehicle metaphor, I mean, there are different types of vehicles. You know, maybe we're looking here at a kind of a fairly robust all-terrain chassis, which...
I was going to say a Toyota Auris. You know, because they never break down, apparently.
They never break down. Well,
I was talking to a taxi driver not a couple of days ago. Kenny was telling me all about it. The Auris, really well, that's only, your only man.
Well, you know, and I think it is quite interesting that the Klopp seems so, like, he's kind of so positive about him, like, in the sense of he wants everyone to know that this isn't his decision. You know, he's absolutely been gunning to keep Wijnaldum, and yet they haven't done it. So I do find that a sort of an interesting one. I mean, if they're lucky that this didn't happen last season, is all I can say, because there was talk, remember, this time last year, or, you know, rather in August, or at the end of last season, that Wijnaldum might join Barcelona then. And imagine that deal had actually gone through. Imagine they had cashed in, so to speak. If they had cashed in on Wijnaldum, who's in the last year of his contract, and sold him to Barcelona for 20 million or something like that, where would they be in the league now? Right, they definitely wouldn't be in the Champions League places. They would have been in a lot of trouble. And I kind of feel as though he could continue to play at the same level for another two or three seasons. So I think, assuming that Liverpool aren't going to go back to him, with the sort of offer that they've so far resisted giving him, he could be a big player for someone who is prepared to do it. I mean, when you look around, who's going to give him this type of money? Is it Barcelona? Are Barcelona seriously going to pay him money that Liverpool felt he wasn't worth, given their, you know, massive debt problems and the fact they're signing Aguero, you know, another sort of older player in free transfer? I don't know. I mean, I look at a team like Paris Saint-Germain and I think, well, they could afford him. And they really need a player like that. You know, he could be huge for them. Who knows where he's going to end up? But I do think there's an interesting question there in terms of where do you draw the line in terms of giving players over 30 big contracts? You know, how much attention do you pay to the age and how much to the condition of the player?
Yeah, the idea that 30 is just an arbitrary, like, that's a number, and after that you don't take into account, like, the personal history of the player. It does seem kind of daft to me. Rory Smith, Jonathan Wilson, coming up next.
Most sports nutrition experts would argue that the fueling begins, in fact, the most important element of it is the day before, and particularly the night before. So if you could take us through your routine.
To win the Premier League is a war on nutrition.
Okay, well, the night before I had sort of a chicken salad.
Yeah, perfect. Lovely, perfect.
I put a bit of pesto on. I mean, oh, I put okay. half a jar.
That's too much pesto, but it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. And I actually bulked up that chicken salad with a little bit of Israeli couscous.
We're still okay. We're still in the realms of pretty good nutrition, I would say, the day before a race.
I had two beers.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein.
Okay, not ideal, but not the end of the world.
I had a small Pringles.
You know the Ritter Sport bars?
I hadn't seen cornflake one before.
Nobody had any soup to start with. Nobody had any puddings to finish with. They had fish and chips.
Okay, I had a whiskey and Coke.
No, come on, not great. Not after the beers.
Well, it was a whiskey and Coke Zero.
You know, you probably know what direction I was thinking. We'll have another whiskey.
You could have one drink, no more, and then you're back to the hotel and you're off to bed.
Then I was thinking, what will I have?
Nah, you know what,
I'll have a cup of tea.
Okay, perfect.
I had tea, then I had
a few digestive biscuits.
Well, there was a suggestion that there was sort of an all-you-can-eat sort of a thing going on.
I wasn't counting them. They were like buns to an elephant. I was just hoovering them up. And then just before I went to bed, I had a slice of toast with Nutella.
No!
It was whole grain bread.
Well, it's great to welcome Rory Smith and Jonathan Wilson to the show. And Rory, I'm going to start with you because we've just been talking about Gini Wijnaldum and his message to the Liverpool supporters saying someday they deserve to know the true story of what happened here. I see that you've been palling around with Jordan Henderson for a few months at this stage. He didn't happen to spill the beans at any stage about what's going on with his very good friend and colleague, former colleague now, it appears, Gini Wijnaldum.
No, Gini Wijnaldum's future didn't come up. I think I'd be interested. I mean, obviously, I don't know. I do not know the real story, but I would imagine that the kind of Occam's razor applies, doesn't it? And the likeliest kind of theory behind it is probably the right one, which is that Wijnaldum wanted either too much money or, I suspect, more likely maybe too long a contract for Liverpool to offer him at this age, which is 30, which is, and you know, Gini Wijnaldum has been, I think, an underrated part of Liverpool's success. He is a very important player for them. One thing that Henderson did mention is that he's really important behind the scenes. I think Liverpool's club policy is that you don't offer 3-4 year contracts to 30-year-olds, which is a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit cold-hearted, but also makes perfect sense. And I suspect that in the pandemic, they felt, well, look, there's not much we can do. We're reaching a natural juncture. Let's just go our separate ways. And it'll be really interesting to see who Wijnaldum signs for now. Does I think wherever he does go, is going to get a player that has not quite got the appreciation he deserves over the last 5 years for all the honours he's won, for all that he is one of those underrated players who everyone says is. He's so underrated, which kind of defeats the point of being underrated. I think he's a thoroughly modern midfielder and he will be a really good signing for anybody, with the possible exception of Barcelona, where he will not kind of transform the team within 3 months and be blamed for the sacking of a coach.
What do you make of it, Jonathan? I mean, you know, they do have already a 35-year-old player in James Milner. I mean, you know, what's the difference between giving a 30-year-old a 4-year contract and giving him a series of 1-year contracts that takes him up to 35?
Well, I guess that's Wijnaldum's position, isn't it? That Milner did do it incrementally. I mean, Wijnaldum, he was trying to push a line that God had told him to do this, and he just had to have faith in God. So, but yeah, I'm sure Rory's right. It is a contract issue. I don't know. It seemed to happen with Liverpool quite a lot in the 80s. It's suddenly a player, for reasons I never quite understood, would decide he was leaving. And I guess that was always a money issue as well. So,
well, who can you think of?
Well, I mean, Rush obviously came back. Who else had happened with? Souness had happened with. Did it happen with Craig Johnston? There was a few who sort of... It just sort of felt like it had reached the natural end that they either wanted to challenge themselves elsewhere, or John Aldridge it happened with, or they wanted the great. And of course,
wasn't John Aldridge, you know, sort of turfed out, kicking and screaming, begging not to be made to join Real Sociedad?
Well, possibly, but I mean, it's sort of a sense that these things sort of reach a natural conclusion. I don't know. It feels the fuss over it, or maybe fuss is the wrong word because it's too pejorative. But the sense of it being something kind of slightly shocking, I don't wonder if it feels sort of a slightly odd sort of super club idea where players are supposed to just go to the place where they'll win the most trophies rather than go to the place where they'll have the most satisfaction.
Sorry, what do you mean by that last point?
Well, I think in right up till even mid-90s, there was a sense that players didn't necessarily just do what was going to win them the most medals. They would do what was right for them and their family, which might be to do with money, it might be to do with personal development, it might be to do with challenges, it might be to do with however they saw the rest of their life going. It might just be they'd been in the same place for sort of 5 or 6 years and fancied a change. Whereas now I sort of think that the players are almost judged if they don't just go to the biggest club to win the most medals. I think, you know, Ed Nazar, I think, is a great example of that. He was somebody who was very, very happy in London, and maybe there was a sense that he didn't quite push himself as hard as he could have done, but up to a point, so what? He was still a great player. He was still very useful to that team. He was still winning things. Mm. But there was a sense that, oh, to get to the next level, he's got to go to Barcelona or Real Madrid. And so eventually, with what seemed to me a significant level of reluctance, he allows himself to be talked into this. And I know there's been an injury, which has been the main reason, but it hasn't gone well at all. And you sort of think, if he had that injury at Chelsea, people would have been much more understanding and much more sympathetic to him.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the player who springs to mind in relation to what you're just saying there is Harry Kane. We get to him in a second here. But I think, Roy, there is an interesting point highlighted by the case of both Van Alden and actually Kane. Because I saw Kane speaking to Gary Neville recently. He made the point, he said, I feel like I could have another career. Meaning like that he was at the halfway point of his career, aged, what is he, 28 now? Or maybe
nearly 27.
So... so he is, until he's 28, he's
that is
he,
how it works, yeah.
So he feels like he's only at the halfway point, which I was kind of thinking, well, you know, that sounds a bit optimistic to me. And then, you know, you see what's happening around Europe. Luis Suarez wins La Liga for Atletico. Robert Lewandowski breaks Gerd Müller's record. What is he now, 32? Like it seems as though players can actually keep going for longer. I mean, the case of Wijnaldum is interesting. Liverpool have obviously decided, look, you know, you're too old to get that type of contract. And I'm kind of wondering, is he really, though? Maybe those principles need to be looked at again.
I think you're right. There's a slightly different context to Wijnaldum, which is that Liverpool's model is to do with, and I think this is the interesting challenge facing Liverpool over the summer and the next year or two, is that Liverpool's model has always been based on kind of rearing players fattening players for sale, and then selling at the peak of their value. And so I wonder if part of Liverpool's thinking is that they need to get a 23-year-old in, or 21, 22, 23-year-old, who they can then have for 4 years, and when they're 27 and one of the best midfielders in the world, sell for a huge sum of money. That I think is a kind of underappreciated part of Liverpool's success over the last year. I mentioned this in the piece that I wrote off the game yesterday, which you can read if you like. It's all right. It's not great. But Liverpool got $50 million, just after thinking dollars, for Ryan Kent, Rafa Camacho and Danny Ings. That's how Liverpool have kind of been able to break transfer records, is by having squad players to sell. And I wonder if part of their thinking is not just that Wijnaldum wanted too long a contract, or that he wanted too much money and wasn't prepared to kind of meet them in the middle, or they weren't prepared to offer him kind of close enough to what he wants, depending on your perspective. But also that if you have a place in the squad occupied by a 31, 32-year-old, you have no resale value in the squad. And I think that will have factored into Liverpool's thinking. I think more broadly, you're right, though, which is that, and it makes sense, and I don't know why I haven't thought of this before. I had this conversation with somebody who I can't remember a little while ago, but there is no reason, given all of the advances in sports science, in nutrition. I spoke to Lewandowski a little while ago, and he has his pudding first, and that's the secret. That's how he's been able to score goals into his 30s. It's why he's getting better, even as he's going grey. Just eat your creme brulee before you have your starter. That's the secret. And with the advances in medicine, in sports science, in nutrition, all that stuff, the fact that football is actually considerably more like professional now than it was even 15 years ago, the idea that a career ends at 33, or, you know, that the peak of a career ends at 32, 33, it's probably wrong. It is probably now 35, 36, because they can get that little bit more out of their body even without going to the Milan lab and using their, you know, their secrets of their success for kind of prolonging careers. So I think Wijnaldum probably has a point that just because he's 30. Maybe that's a little bit, maybe that thinking itself is a little bit old school, that 30 represents the turning of the tide for a player. Maybe that point now doesn't come until 32, 33, and that's when they start to wane a little bit. But there's loads of players who are still going on at 35, 36, and obviously Ronaldo and Ibrahimovic and stuff. But Milner, you know, Milner is not, he's kind of seventh choice midfielder for Liverpool. I think he's an important part of the dressing room, but he'd still start for quite a lot of Premier League teams. And that maybe isn't appreciated, because there is this weird assumption that anyone who's not a star for a top, you know, top three, top four team would automatically just be another squad player at Southampton or Newcastle. Whereas in reality, James Milner would probably be the best player at both of those clubs. And it's the same with Wijnaldum. I think it'll be really interesting, the reaction to whoever Wijnaldum signs for, if it's in England, will be very much, well, he was rubbish for Liverpool because he wasn't Mohamed Salah. And there will be a realisation relatively quickly that Jorginho Wijnaldum's really good. But I think there is perhaps a point at which the upper limit for when players kind of started to decline has shifted, and we being football culture in general, but clubs themselves haven't quite realised that yet.
I mean, yeah. I think that's all true. I completely agree with that. There is a specific context here, though, which is that Liverpool are an old team.
Yes.
And so the three forwards, two of them are 29, one of them will turn 29 very soon. Henderson is 30, Milner's obviously 420, whatever he is. He's so old, he doesn't really count. Van Dijk is 29. Yeah. Matip is 29. So from a squad management point of view, if you suddenly give Wijnaldum a 3-year contract and a slight pay rise, you've got half a dozen other players who are going to be coming in going, well, hang on, last year he got this, and come on, I've scored however many goals, I've done this, I've done that. You've got to give me at least that. And the danger is that while it's entirely plausible that half of them, three quarters of that, what, half dozen I mentioned, could go on to the 35, 36, A, you really don't want a squad with six 36-year-olds in it, and B, a couple of them probably will fall away. And so Wijnaldum maybe is, unfortunately for him, the necessary sacrifice just to try and maintain that balance within the squad.
I think that's absolutely right, although I would point Jonathan to Italian football if he thinks that people don't want squads for the 36-year-olds.
I think, at elite level, Rory, sorry.
I think that's a really good point, and it's probably the best lens to look at the Wijnaldum thing through is squad management. That Liverpool's the circumstances in which they work has changed completely. It's not just that they can't, that, you know, that Bournemouth are not going to be giving them £25 million for a striker that Liverpool don't need or want in the future. That those days are over. They don't have a lot of difficulty raising money. But also, I think that I would hazard probably an educated guess that at some point Liverpool had planned to sell either Salah or Mane for over £100 million, and that would then fund the rebuild or the next generation, the next iteration of this Liverpool team, and that's not going to happen either. So I think they probably had to start thinking, right, we need to carry out this refresh, and we need to make difficult decisions. And Wijnaldum, it was really nice being at Anfield yesterday, because he is a little bit of an unsung hero in that Liverpool team. He is a much better player than he's given credit for, and it was really nice to see how much he means to the fans and to the players. That was quite sweet. You expect it for Aguero, because Aguero is one of the greatest players the Premier League's ever had, and he's arguably Manchester City's greatest ever player. He's a legend, Sergio Aguero, an overused word, but an accurate one for him. Wijnaldum's not in that class, obviously, but it's nice to see even that those players get those send-offs. But I think Liverpool, as much as it feels harsh and as much as it feels early and as much as it's kind of the more difficult decision, you can see why they've made it. They do have to start refreshing that squad. They have to start rebuilding a little bit, because in a couple of years, even if all those players are there and still playing quite well at 30, 31, they will be staring down the barrel of a real problem.
Okay, well, what about then, you mentioned Aguero there, Rory. You saw, I'm assuming, Jonathan, you saw Pep Guardiola's reaction to, I'm not sure what he was reacting to. He became emotional talking about Sergio Aguero. He said, we cannot replace him, was among the things that he managed to get out. Would Harry Kane not be a pretty good replacement? I see the stat from who scored that Harry Kane is the first player to finish top for both goals and assists in a Premier League season since Andy Cole in 1994.
Wow.
Which is phenomenal about Andy Cole topping the assist chart. That time because he scored, I think, 34 goals.
I'd love to know how many of them were rebounds off a keeper or...
Well, is he? I heard a lot of people talk about Harry Kane saying he's the best player in the league, not just Tottenham people. Ryan Mason certainly said it. Hugo Lloris, I think, said it. But there was other people echoing that view. Do you think that he... I mean, because we spoke about the Harry Kane situation actually at some length with Jack Pitbrook on Thursday, and a lot of it was to do with, can this deal actually happen? But do you think that Harry Kane is the sort of player who will give Man City the kind of cultural cachet that maybe they've been looking for to match the football dominance, something to really grab the attention of the football public in England and say, we are the best and you have to pay attention to us more than everybody else and we've got the England captain now?
I mean, if getting 100 points in a season doesn't do that, I think they're not going to get the credit anyway. If anything, signing Kane would diminish their achievements because it would just be splashing a load of cash on a manifestly brilliant player. Would Kane make them better? I can see how he would fit perfectly into that team, certainly. That City, a lot of the season have played with a false nine. I'm not sure Guardiola necessarily wants to play with a false nine. It's just the attributes he prioritises in the centre-forward are those that are often found in a false nine. Kane would seem to me to have all of them. He can hold the ball up, he can drop deep. He's very good at releasing people running beyond him. So, you can imagine him and Sterling. We've seen with England that can work. You can imagine him linking up well with Foden, which again, from an England point of view, hopefully that will happen this summer. But he's also a great finisher. He scores from outside the box. He'd give you a great variety of goal. He gives you an aerial threat from set plays. He seems to me one of a few players who would be a clear benefit to City. However, are they really going to be willing to spend the 120 million, 150 million to prize him away from Tottenham when he's got 3 years left in his contract? It's possible, but I don't think it's by any means guaranteed. And once they sign a player for how many? Nine figures, is that? Yeah, a nine-figure fee, rather than their record signing being yet another centre-back for 60-odd million, then that jibe of, oh, well, you've just bought the title, that becomes a bit more hurtle. I mean, maybe they don't care about that. There's
I can't understand why they would care about it. Like,
you say that, but Guardiola was...
He keeps going on about it. Obviously, he cares about it.
I mean, he swore on the BBC about it. That's how hard... That's how much he feels about it.
I'm glad the BBC protected me from hearing exactly what words he used by bleeping out a whole section of a sentence. But, sure, I mean, okay, Guardiola obviously gets annoyed about that for obvious reasons because, he wants people to acknowledge that his own contribution has been great, and presumably that of some of the players who he respects so much. But the point with Harry Kane, I mean, people are going to say that about City anyway. Like, everyone's going to just say that about City, City can live with that.
But Jonathan's right to an extent. I don't know whether it's deliberate, but it certainly struck me as being sort of a policy that what City have done over the last few years is add a lot of players who are very expensive but not quite kind of Daily Mail fulminating about all that's gone wrong with the game expensive, like Ruben, the endless, it's 50 million quid for 14 left backs, 60 million quid for as many centre halves as they can find. They've never kind of gone and got they've never gone for the jaw-dropping signing. Yeah, they've not done a Neymar. They tried for Messi, but on a free, and I'm sure that there would have been a kind of... I mean, Messi's a bit different, he's Messi. So I think there would have been an acceptance that you just pay Messi whatever he wants, and if you can do it, you do it. But they haven't gone out for a long time to try and break transfer records, which is what signing Kane would do. And, would they care? Yes.
But what I'm talking about here, right, is Kane is an opportunity. Like, okay, look at what Neymar and Mbappe have done for PSG in terms of their profile. I know that Lille have just won the French League. So from the point of view of this season, not a whole lot, okay? Lille have done... Burak Yilmaz has had a better season than Neymar and Mbappe, okay? But, like, everybody wants to watch PSG's games in the Champions League. Nobody is saying, oh, it's just PSG in the second round. As happens with the City games, it helps the PSG. City always seem to be playing against Shakhtar or Mönchengladbach. It's true. But there's something about having these stars in your team. I mean, it's basically the Florentino Perez idea. I mean, look, people want to watch these guys. Harry Kane is a player who, Well, I'm wondering if he is this type of player. I mean, he speaks himself about, like, I'm not afraid to say I want to get to the level of Ronaldo and Messi, which, okay, I'm not sure if he ever will. But do you think he is the type of player who could turn City into, like, the big box office team? Not just the best team or the most powerful team, but the team that everybody wants to watch?
No, basically, because although he is, I think he'd make them much more interesting in England, because there would be, that would be the dominant story of next season, would be how does Harry Kane fit into Guardiola's system? How, you know, how many goals can he score in a team that creates endless chances? The likelihood is they'll win the league with or without Kane, but they might win it in greater kind of, with greater emphasis with Kane. But I don't know if internationally, I don't think he's got the sort of profile that matches Neymar or Mbappe or whoever. I think that's another level up, and I'm not sure that you can quite get there just by scoring lots of goals for Manchester City. And I think from both the club and the player's point of view, the one thing that would be really fascinating is the meaning of it. So I thought Jonathan made a great point that we now expect players to go to, we expect players to go to clubs where they can win trophies in industrial quantities, and that's the legacy of Messi and Ronaldo, that, and to an extent Fergie's Man United, that, you know, unless you've won 13 Premier League titles, are you really a great? No, not really. You know, that's the bar. There's this weird kind of creep towards, unless you can match the greatest thing that's ever happened, whatever you've achieved does not count. And it's a really strange sort of dynamic within football. So Kane would go to Man City for trophies and he would win them. But what would those trophies mean if you're in a place where you are essentially guaranteed to win trophies? And ditto for City. I think the question is, does it feel like less of an achievement deep down to the fans, who I'm sure that, you know, if they win the lead with Harry Kane scoring 40 goals, they will tell you that it means exactly the same as it ever did, and that nothing's changed. But I think a lot of fans do wrestle with that idea of, if you sign the sure thing, is it as exciting when the sure thing comes to pass? I don't know if it is. I think that's just human. I don't think that's just Man City. I think the stories that captivate us most in football are the ones where there is a degree of jeopardy and unlikelihood. Whereas if it just feels very formulaic, very very much like, we're the best team, we've added the best player, we've won the league, I don't know if that would feel quite as kind of overwhelmingly exciting as, I don't know, Leicester's a stupid example because it's such an exception, but, you know, Inter Milan winning the league in Italy this season when...
This model seems to have worked over the years for, you know, Real Madrid. It seems good enough for the fans of Real Madrid. You know, why not Man City? We're the best, we buy the best, we play the best, we win the trophy, you know, everyone's happy.
Do you think the fans of Real Madrid are happy?
No.
No, they're not happy.
And also, look at the identity of the clubs. You know, Real Madrid literally have a word royal in their title. They wear this sort of regal white. Their whole, from the 50s onwards, their whole thing has been about, you know, we're the greatest. We have this status. We have, you know, the best players in the world all come here. You know, Manchester City, the exact opposite of that. And you know, to flip the identity of a club from being kind of the working class strugglers to being the, you know, extraordinarily wealthy club who just sort of buy the best players. You know, they don't bother to develop them, they just go to the shop and buy the best ones, and when they're finished they chuck them out. That's a complete shift in mentality.
I mean, it's already happened though. I mean, that's been the case for some time at this stage.
There's at least an element of trying to sort of balance the two things, an element of compromise there, and the fact that Guardiola's style is so based on the collective. If Friedrich Engels were watching football today, which of the best teams would he be most keen on watching? It would be City.
No.
Because it might be Leeds. But I mean, when I said elite, I meant them in the Champions League.
Okay, right, okay.
Well, yeah, no, it's Friedrich Engels.
He would hate the Champions League.
He would hate the Champions League, but I'm assuming he's being forced to watch it.
Do you think that Friedrich Engels would not be the sort of person who supports Dulwich Hamlet? Like, he'd have AMF in his Twitter bio, and he'd be taking pictures at Dulwich Hamlet to just make it clear that he doesn't agree with the capitalist conquering of football. I think Wilson's got a point that it is a shift. It is a massive shift for City to, if you sign the England captain, and look, this isn't to say that he wouldn't do brilliantly for them or that he shouldn't sign for them. It would be, I think there's an interesting question over how well Guardiola could incorporate him into his team, because it would involve shifting the way that City play. That in itself would be really interesting. But signing the England captain for a British record fee would be the end of the story that City tell themselves about them being an insurgent force.
I don't know if anyone's still saying that about.
No, of course they do. The one defence they all have when you bring up their ownership is, it's this cartel of the elite, the established powers, the grandees. They're massed against us because we're the insurgents. That is absolutely the story they tell themselves.
Yeah. So you honestly think you both sort of think that this Harry Kane to sit again? Not that I just want to recapitulate our whole piece from Thursday about this. I mean, it's all hypothetical. I honestly don't see where either of you are coming from on this. Like, I mean, it just seems to me as though he would be a great signing that could hugely increase the profile of the club. And I don't really see what else there's other than the fact that I don't think it's actually going to happen, because there's no price at which it makes sense for Man City to buy him that Tottenham would be prepared to sell him for.
But there's two slightly different things there that you've pushed together. So one is, would he make them a better side? Would he make them more likely to win the Champions League? Would he make them likely to win the Premier League by an even greater margin? Yes, absolutely. Would he fit in the Guardiola collective? Yes, definitely. So he is that sort of perfect blend of being, he's not a celebrity player in the way that Neymar is a celebrity player. He's a high profile, great footballer, but he's humble enough to submit himself to the work ethic and the team dynamic of City. So in that sense, he works. But do City really want to increase their profile? Is that their aim? You know, they're not in this for the reasons that the other owners are in this. They're not in this to make.
Is that not the reason that they're in? Like, I'm not saying to increase your profile as a means to the end of making more money. Although I guess that is often a happy byproduct of that. But you know, whatever it is, Manchester City's owners want to own Manchester City for. Surely the idea of having, you know, the team that everyone wants to watch is one that interests any owner.
I'm not sure it's as simple as that. There's that Sheikh Mansour interview earlier this month, when he said something about how City's investment in players is an example for all business people. And I thought that was very telling, that he recognises it's not just about going out and getting the biggest and brightest and flashiest. It's about targeting your resources successfully. And that's what City have done really well. I mean, okay, there've been a handful of defenders who haven't worked out, but fundamentally, quite apart from having, you know, riches beyond compare, they have actually spent their money incredibly well.
So it's actually, you think they're kind of playing that it's John Henry who they're trying to compete with. It's like, we want to be the smartest guys in the room, not just the sexiest team.
I just think there's an element that recognises that being brash, to going out and doing what Thaksin Shinawatra did, and going out and just buying Rubinho for no reason other than
that was Sheikh Mansour who did that. That was his first signing.
The mistakes they made at the beginning then. They've learned from that, and I think that is significant.
I think what you say about wanting to be smart I think that is important to City. That sense that they are doing things the right way, that they would, I think, take exception, maybe rightly, maybe wrongly, I'm not entirely sure, to the idea that Liverpool are the kind of the data club, the club that kind of has the brains, whereas City have the wealth. That isn't something that City, basically, you get the sense that, I'm not talking about the fans, I'm talking internally, don't particularly like it when anybody else gets praised for something, basically. So there is this idea that...
I think that might be because City are going, well, hang on, we're better than them, and we never see.
Yeah, possibly. And look, it's not rare in football that as you both know, that clubs get very jealous of other clubs. You know, there's all these false equivalences drawn between, well, you're praising them for doing this, but when we did this thing that sort of sounds vaguely similar but is in fact completely different, you didn't praise us, why not?
Yeah.
And that's true of all teams, that they don't like others getting credit. I think City are conscious that if you start going and paying nine-figure sums for established players, that it's much harder to refute the idea that you have bought success. And I think that matters to City. Although they, on the surface, it's absurd that City would City should really, if anything, kind of revel in the idea that, yeah, look, they are the insurgent force. They've got this vast wealth of a nation state backing them, and they've used it to completely overturn the natural order of football. And maybe not the natural order, but you know, they've used it to overturn the established elite, this horrible cartel. That's a perfectly good story for City to tell themselves. But I think they want it to be known, because they're not wrong here, that they have been clever with it, that they have done all the right things, that they've also invested in their youth academy and their data department, and they've got a Yale PhD working for them, and they've done all this stuff that is really smart, and they are smarter than everybody else. They've got the sister club model, which nobody else had thought of apart from Red Bull and Udinese, and that's cleverer, and they are the great disruptors. That's what they pride themselves on, as being disruptors. Whereas if you go and sign the England captain for 150 million quid, you're not really disrupting anything, are you? You're just kind of doing what everybody else does who's got lots of money. You are suddenly becoming Real Madrid. Mm. And I think that, I'm not saying that means it's a bad idea, or that it wouldn't work, or that they won't do it, but I think that is a fairly fundamental shift in how they operate. And in terms of on the pitch, he'd score loads of goals, but Kane would necessitate a bit of a shift in the way the City set up, and I think that in itself would be really interesting to see. And it may be that Guardiola decides, you know, Guardiola spent his entire career trying to build a team exclusively made up of midfielders. His record with specialist strikers is mixed, to be perfectly honest. And as much as Kane is a bit, you know, he's different to Ibrahimovic and Eto'o and even to an extent Aguero, he would involve bringing either Kane or Haaland or whoever in would involve changing the way they play. And that's the other factor, which is that if you sign Kane this summer, you are ruling yourself out of Mbappe and Haaland, particularly Haaland. And that is a big call to make when Haaland is kind of Harry Kane, but 7 years younger.
Okay, so welcome to Tottenham, Harry Kane. The last thing I want to ask both of you just quickly is, I guess if Brendan Rodgers, if Leicester had finished in the top four, then the manager of the year will be a fairly simple choice of Brendan Rodgers. You know, he would have been the guy who'd really achieved all his objectives. But that didn't happen. So I just want to ask you both, who do you think it's going to be? There is obviously there are games this week which could change the calculus somewhat, but you should have a fairly clear idea at this point of who you think has done the best job out of the managers this season. You go first, Rory.
Bielsa, by a mile.
Okay, that's good. I was actually going to suggest him to correct both of your ideas. What about you, Jonathan? would you also say Bielsa?
I mean, I think there's four real candidates who are Bielsa, obviously. David Moyes, I mean, you know, what West Ham have done, given where I thought he'd be to where they are, that's the biggest gap. I mean, you know, the thing is, Bielsa's been brilliant, but I sort of expected him to be brilliant. So I sort of thought Leeds would be around about 9th or 10th, and, you know, sure enough, they are. But maybe I shouldn't mark Bielsa down just because I previously thought highly of him. Guardiola, I think, has done a great job for all what we said about the resources, the way he's changed the way they play. And I think Rodgers has done an exceptional job. And yeah, for second season running, the squad has ended up being not quite deep enough. But yeah, we know that he's fighting an uphill battle there. So I think you can make very good cases for all four of those. I clearly am Bielsa biased. But I also feel that I do have some apologising to do to David Moyes before it all goes wrong for him next season. Mm. So I guess I'll say Moyes.
Moyes is the only one who... Guardiola's done a brilliant job, but you can't... It's hard to separate what City have done from the fact that he's been able to rotate seven players in and out of his team every week since January, and nobody else has. So although he's done a brilliant job, I think it doesn't compare to what Bielsa's done with a team that contains Luke Ayling and Liam Cooper and kind of all these players who were written off at the Championship. Leeds spent a reasonable amount in the summer on Rafinha and Rodrigo, but for them to finish ninth is, I think, genuinely extraordinary. And because I know what Wilson means, that you kind of, I thought they'd finish ninth or tenth, but I don't think we should deprive Marcelo Bielsa because of our great genius, Jonathan. I think that would be wrong. I think that he's made the fact that they finished top half, that they've been so comfortable, that they looked so at home in the Premier League, in a way detracts from how unusual and how remarkable that achievement is. I think that he was the great question mark at the start of the season. Can these methods work in the Premier League? And we've seen that not only do they work, but Leeds have thrived. They've drawn with Liverpool at home, they've not lost to City, They've got a point against Man United.
They beat City as well, didn't they?
City at the Etihad with 10 men. So, I mean, like, you look at, this sounds a bit silly, and I have nothing but admiration for Luke Ayling, but you look at, like, Stuart Dallas, who now looks like a kind of...
The cook's down Roberto Carlos.
Well, he can play basically anywhere. I was at Old Trafford and he scored a fantastic goal in the last minute. They lost 6-2 in that game. They never stopped coming. And they were all, if you think back to October, November, when the Leeds were shipping goals occasionally, and there was this kind of, Bielsa's got to change his methods. This isn't the way you play. You've got to not get beaten. You've got to be tougher, blah, blah, blah. One of Guardiola's great legacy to English football will not just be the kind of establishment of Manchester City as the primary force in English football for a generation. It will be the fact that he has abolished a load of myths that English football has told itself for years and years and years about foreign ideas not working. Bielsa is the ultimate, at a much lower level in terms of the quality of his squad, Bielsa is the ultimate proof of that. And I think, as a kind of mental exercise, it's quite interesting to ask whether would Guardiola have got more out of this Leeds team this season than Bielsa has, because I'm not sure he would.
No, not a chance. Not a chance. But, you know, there's something very... why do you think it is, Jonathan, that it's only this one guy who seems to be able to maintain the sort of running around levels of the previous seasons? Why is Marcelo Bielsa able to do this and nobody else seems to be able to do it?
Well, historically, he hasn't been able to do it. It's only the last couple of seasons. Last season, you had the COVID break, whatever impact that had. I mean, I think Leeds would have been promoted anyway, but you know, I think it probably helped them. This season, they've played the fewest games as possible for any team to play by getting themselves knocked out of the League Cup and the FA Cup straight away. But you know, nonetheless, the calendar has been compacted, and that burnout that we've come to expect over for 30 years, we've expected Bielsa teams to burn out, hasn't happened.
30 years.
Well, this is weird thing happens where Leeds fans sort of go, oh, look, we've just won our last four games. We haven't burned out. What are you talking about? I'm talking about the last 28 years. Like, okay, the last two seasons it hasn't, but it happened with Newell's Old Boys in 1992. Like, this has been an ongoing process.
Seems like it doesn't happen anymore.
The fact it's not happening is itself worthy of comment. So whether it's the ever-healthy Yorkshire air or whether it's, he's found a way of moderating his approach, I don't know.
Never underestimate the competitive advantage of Yorkshire. I mean, that is a factor. But I think this was something someone raised to me on Twitter, and I think it's a really interesting point. You wonder whether sports science has caught up to Bielsa's methods and that now the conditioning is so good that he was 30 years ahead of his time, and that was the problem, and he's not anymore. So maybe now Bielsa can have the players do what he needs them to do for an entire season. The other big factor, and I think is one that Leeds fans would accept, Premier League is 8 games shorter than the Championship. So this is a squad that was largely built, one or two players aside, and Rodrigo and Llorente have both missed a lot of the season, was largely built for the Championship. They are used to playing, that incredibly hectic schedule of Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday. So you wonder whether maybe the Premier League wasn't quite as tough for them as everyone assumed it would be. But I think that no team has got as many points for its wage bill as Leeds. And I would say that gives it to Bielsa.
Okay, lovely stuff. Guys, a very well done from all of us to Marcelo Bielsa, who has, if anything, been underpraised this season, I would say. Rory Smith and Jonathan Wilson, thanks a million for joining us today.
Cheers. Thank you.
That team chain brings me back in. Aztec Gold.
Good guy, good guy.
Oh my God, could somebody turn the treble up even more?
If I can change.
Answers please on a postcard to St. and Greavesy, Littlewood's Cup competition.
We don't have enough treble on this thing.
Okay, Ken. Thank you for your efforts today. We'll be back later with a quick chat about Big Phil's ridiculous USPGA win last night. What do you think of a sporting competition, Ken, that can be won by a 50-year-old?
I think I think it's great.
Yeah.
I mean,
I actually have to say it was one of the best golf tournaments, and I'm not just saying it because Shane Lowry and Padraig Harrington had the time of their lives shooting 3 under and finishing up joint fourth, I think. Absolutely brilliant result for the two lads. Anyway, that's coming up a little later today. Coming up this week, we'll be talking Dublin Kerry, discovering why young tennis players don't win tournaments anymore, and of course the Europa and Champions League club finals coming up later this week as well. Thanks a million, Ken.
Thank you very much as well, Ciarán.
And thanks a million for listening.
It's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.